Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a Baghdad courtroom this weekend, 3.5 years after being toppled by the American invasion, former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein was sentenced to hang for crimes against humanity. It was the first of several potential trials for the former Iraqi dictator, and it focused on one of the smaller chapters of killing in his 24 years of brutal rule. President Bush and his advisors have been saying this is a step toward democracy. President Bush himself saying yesterday that this was a clear step toward democracy for Iraq.
Saddam Hussein trial is a milestone in the Iraqi people's efforts to replace the rule of a tyrant with the rule of law. And it's a major achievement for this young democracy.
Joining me first in this segment from Baghdad is Borzu Dargahi, bureau chief in Baghdad for the Los Angeles Times. Borzu, thanks very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
How is the news being received in Iraq in the terms that President Bush is describing here? Do Iraqis see this verdict as a major achievement for a young democracy?
Well, I think that's a really good question, the question, actually. I think that Americans, there's this sort of Anglo-Saxon tradition of the courtroom as this healing, this higher kind of exercise, this place where social and political problems are exposed and solved. You just don't have that in the Middle East. I just think it's kind of an artificial implant here, that view of this trial. And what you had instead was this, you know, I mean, it would have been great if it would have healed some of the wounds of this society, if through this trial there could have been some truth and reconciliation. But it's pretty apparent that more than anything, it has done the opposite. It has widened the sectarian rift between the Shiites and the Sunnis. They reacted totally differently to this trial, this verdict.
And what about the president's assertion? We heard it there in his speech from yesterday, that this verdict is a milestone in the Iraqi people's efforts to replace the rule of a tyrant with the rule of law, a milestone in establishing the rule of law. Do Iraqis see it that way?
It doesn't seem that way. I think such a lesson, while some might glean that, I think it might get lost in contemporary Iraq, where you know, hundreds of people die each week in sectarian civil warfare. I think that perhaps that lesson might not carry through. The rule of law that doesn't seem to apply much when you've got, like, you know, dozens of bodies that show up every morning with drill holes in their torsos and bullet holes in their head.
Borzu, what about Iraq itself, Baghdad and other cities? We hear there's a curfew that's been established. Even during the day, people not permitted to drive and sometimes not allowed on the streets. How widespread is the lockdown there?
Yeah, it really bites. We can't really do anything because of this lockdown. It's pretty widespread. It's really pretty much impossible to do anything, go anywhere. And the country is in a sort of state of suspended animation. There's basically no businesses that are open, very little civic or political or commercial life. And you know, it's everyone's kind of trapped in their homes for now.
There's been a lot of speculation about the timing of this verdict coming almost on the eve of the United States midterm elections. What about the independence of this court process and the timing of the announcement of the verdict?
Well, I mean, U.S. officials strenuously deny that they had anything to do with this. The U.S. Officials that we deal with that are the embassy's liaison to the trial, they assure us that they, and they have a point that, you know, they say to us, we've been grumbling to you guys since, you know, spring that we wish this thing would get over with, and we've been trying to push them to get this thing over with much sooner than it is taking place than now. But, I mean, that appearance is there, that, you know, this was a time to provide some goodwill for the Iraq adventure right as the elections are coming up.
And what about the timetable going forward? If Saddam's going to hang, if the appeal doesn't turn it another way, what kind of timetable might that be on? When might he be executed?
Well, it's really up to the appellate court. It's a 9-judge panel. and they have to deliberate and exhaust all appeals. Once all appeals are exhausted, the sentence must be carried out within 30 days. The Iraqi High Tribunal is ostensibly independent, but in the past there have been times when it has bowed to political pressure. Judges have been replaced, for example, twice in both the Dujail case and the Anfal case. And so it remains to be seen whether it will bow to political pressure, perhaps, and perhaps execute him sooner rather than later, or later rather than sooner.
And finally, what about on the other side of this lockdown, curfew? What are Iraqi and American authorities expecting in the streets? Celebration or more conflict?
Well, I think the celebrations have pretty much died down. There was a few street protests today, one in Fallujah, a few others in mostly Sunni towns in Diyala province. Who knows? I have a feeling that it'll just be back to normal, just the normal day-to-day horrific acts of violence that plague Iraq today.
Borzu Dargahi, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Borzu Dargahi, Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. He joined us from the Iraqi capital. We turn now to Graham Allison. He's professor of government at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Kennedy School. His most recent book is Realizing Human Rights. Graham Allison, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All kinds of interesting news this weekend around the Saddam Hussein verdict. I mean, first of all, there's the verdict itself. Then we have a raft of neocons coming out condemning the prosecution of the war, how it's gone. Some key military newspapers calling for the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld. And, of course, all those American troops are still in Iraq. Let me put the question to you first, just at a very broad level. Here we have a verdict now. Saddam Hussein is supposed to hang. There's an appeal. Most people don't expect it to be overturned. Was this worth it? Was this worth the blood and treasure, all that's been spent in terms of American lives and money for this verdict on this former Iraqi leader?
Well, in a word, no. I think if you asked any thinking American today, if we knew what we know now, at the time that the decision was made to attack Iraq in the spring of 2003, with all the pluses and all the minuses, and I would say that bringing Saddam low is a plus, I don't think there's anybody in their right mind who would say this was worth it.
Not worth it because bringing one man to justice is not worth all those hundreds of billions and those thousands of American lives? Or by what measure not worth it?
Well, I think you need to take by all the measures. But I think if we asked what has been accomplished today, we find ourselves in the midst of an emerging civil war in which the situation is worse today than it was a year ago today, and it was worse a year ago today than it was a year before that, and we don't seem to find any potential exit. It's certainly a positive thing that a brutal dictator who killed many of his own citizens and many Iranians has been felled. That's certainly a positive. But at the price of 2,500 American lives, thousands, many thousands badly wounded, and tens of thousands of Iraqis killed, even hundreds of thousands, and in a situation which is now becoming anarchic and chaotic. I think that looking at it in retrospect, it's impossible, I believe, to make the argument that it was worth it if we see the situation that we have today.
Graham Allison, what do you make of neocon supporters, boosters of this war from several years back, coming forward over the weekend? We hear in a forthcoming Vanity Fair article, Richard Perl, Kenneth Edelman, and others, and saying that the performance of the administration in the prosecution of the war has been crushingly bad, and even that they would not have promoted this war if they knew how poorly it would be executed. How do you hear that line from these men now?
Well, I find it sane that they at least acknowledge that if one looks and sees the results of the policies that they advocated and supported, that they've turned out catastrophically from the point of view of American interests, and therefore was not worth it. So I think that's at least a sign of in the reality zone. But I beneath this, I find a more troubling question, which is, what in what way are the policy influentials accountable in our system and society? What does a policy advocate, an advisor, who has at least some responsibility for a course of action, what does he owe or she owe to the rest of the society after something turns out to be colossally bad? And to some extent, this is the situation that is the, you know, as the sink is the ship is sinking, people, of course, point fingers at somebody else. But I think the question that should be asked across the community of people who are policy influentials and advisors and advocates and who write op-eds in the various newspapers is, okay, now let's look at and see. I mean, should there be some equivalent of medical malpractice?
Accountability not just at the polls, but for thought leaders as well.
Right.
I mean, we have Kenneth.
I mean, if it were doctors doing this and you had recommended this lobotomy or shock treatment for somebody who had a mental issue, you know, you would be your license would be taken away to practice.
So,
or in the legal area, I think sometimes people are disbarred. So I would hope that this would lead to some internal soul searching on the part of the whole policy influential community about the quality of the advice offered.
Well, here we've got Kenneth Edelman. He was on the Defense Policy Board that informally advised President Bush, quite influential before the war. Richard Perl, who chaired the committee right in the middle of all this. Richard Perl saying now, if he knew then what he knows now, Al probably would have said, let's consider other strategies for dealing with the thing that concerns us most, which is Saddam supplying weapons of mass destruction to terrorists. Is there, if you're looking for policy influentials' accountability here, is there a worldview shared by these two, shared by the policy influentials who backed the war in Iraq, that itself ought to be put on a bit of trial here, that may not be, as people, you know, put the blame fully on the administration itself?
Oh, I think absolutely. If you look across the spectrum of support for going to war with Iraq, it included The Economist, The New York Times, Tom Friedman. So it was quite a broad view. And I think the question that we should all be now asking ourselves is, okay, was there almost a collective mistake? It was not universal. And actually, as you point out rightly, that people who held a more realist view of foreign policy as a theory actually said this was a bad idea. And there was a whole group of policy influentials who ultimately took out ads in the New York Times saying, this is a mistaken view of how to deal with the problem of Iraq. I had a debate that I moderated at the Kennedy School between John Deutsch and Bill Kristol back in the spring of 2002, so well before this, in which basically John Deutsch was rightly saying, we've looked at this situation very carefully, and the consequences of going to war with Iraq will own Iraq thereafter and will be left with chaos. If you look at General Zinni, I'd say that's one of the most interesting cases. He was the CENTCOM commander for whom Tommy Franks worked, you know, before Franks became CENTCOM.
Right.
He said, if you're going to do anything like this, as we've been thinking about it for many, many years, it's going to take 500,000 troops, and you're going to be there for 10 years, and we cannot guarantee success. So I think there were voices that had a more sensible view of the situation. And I think it's worth asking, well, what about the alternative views as advocated? And was there something wrong with the fundamental approach?
But help us understand that view that propelled this war forward. If we're looking here to accountability for thought leaders, how would you describe, in essence, the worldview that supported the genesis of the war?
Well, I think it came right out of the heart of the neocon philosophy, as Bill Kristol, a friend of mine and a person whom I hired actually at the Kennedy School a long time ago, the founding editor of Weekly Standard, said in this debate, you can go look at it on the Kennedy School's website where the forums are up. He said, look, the first issue of the Weekly Standard, which we published in 1996, had a picture of Saddam's face on the cover with a no parking sort of sign, you know, through it saying, off Saddam. Mm. We think this is the core problem, and we are in favor of this. Now, where was this coming from? partly, I think, a mistaken understanding of Saddam and of the possibilities of social engineering in nation building after toppling a brutal dictator and attempting to manage the process through occupation of building democracy. That was, I think, a naive idea. It was argued at the time to be a naive idea, and I think it's turned out to be a naive idea. A second notion is, I think, still at the heart of a lot of Bush's rhetoric, which is the notion that democracy is the solution to all our problems, and that democracy is in the first instance, holding votes. We've held a vote among the Palestinians, and Hamas won. We held votes in Egypt, and we see the results of that with the Islamic Brotherhood. We've held a vote in Iraq, and now one sees a Shiite government that wants to be as brutal to the Sunnis as the Sunnis were to the Shiite. So it's not that democracy is not ultimately the best of the alternative systems, but it is that the idea that democracy can follow from the barrel of a gun, and that in any case, democratizing societies that don't have the preconditions and infrastructure is going to be the solution to the problem of terrorism. Again, I think mistake. So I would say it's a pretty good time for a wholesale reexamination of a lot of the philosophical underpinnings, essentially of the neoconservative catechism, but much of which is replicated in at least the Bush rhetoric currently.
We've just got half a minute. If it comes to a question of who lost Iraq, where do you think the finger of responsibility is going to fall heaviest? On the neocon thought leaders, on the Bush administration's execution, on both?
Well, there's enough blame, I think, to go around, and it would seem to me that an appropriate modesty across the spectrum. I mean, there's no question that the administration has been dysfunctional, as Pearl argues. There's no question that Rumsfeld's management of the war has been incompetent. But I think it should lead folks who were advocates of this in the first instance to reexamine their own analysis.
And there we open up a second front in the whole issue of accountability. The voters will have their say tomorrow. We'll see what follows on the thought front. Professor Graham Allison at the Kennedy School at Harvard, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with available real-time traffic monitoring. More information at Acura.com.